Accession number 17826, reel 2.
You mean the zeros?
Yeah, and even the tactics whereby in the Battle of Britain the pilots found that the Hurricanes and Spitfires were generally more manoeuvrable than the 109s from the other German airplanes. It was total reverse, and quite a lot of ex-successful fighter pilots in European theatre got into trouble in Southeast Asia when they tried to mix it with the Japanese, because they had the Army 97s and the Zeros that were exceedingly manoeuvrable aeroplanes and could easily turn inside them. So it was very necessary to be prepared to adopt a tactic of attacking and breaking and getting the hell out of it, not foolishly being, not foolishly mixing it at all.
Did you flew the early Thunderbolts, did you, with the sort of greenhouse cockpit, or the later ones with the teardrop canopy?
We flew the ones with the teardrop canopy. Mm. And they used to say about the Thunderbolt, the best way of taking evasive action is to undo the straps and run around the cockpit. It's a lovely comment. And the cockpit was enormous by standards that we'd been accustomed to. So I developed a bit of an affection for that aeroplane, and meanwhile was sent up to Armada Road for the air fighting gunnery instructor's course there, to find that Chota Carey was back running that organisation, and so he couldn't have had a better guide and mentor than Carey. And I do remember the emphasis that he used to put on the importance of range, line, deflection, and good flying. And he would say, when a person had got a cine film, he said, you know, we can check on your range, we can check on your line, and you're only cheating yourself if you have achieved these results with a lot of slip and skid on, because when the real time comes along, you're going to be the ones that suffer. You're the one that suffers if you don't get your flying accurate as well as your range and your line. He was a great instructor. That was a very good experience, because we did there air-to-air on drogues, and we did a lot of air-to-ground, and tremendous emphasis put on the characteristics that I've mentioned to you in dealing with the Japanese, of not mixing it with them, picking them up early, obviously, coming out of the sun if you possibly can, and getting the hell out of it. And also in terms of the importance of taking violent, evasive action as you were approaching your target to make yourself as difficult to hit as possible. I remember on one occasion doing an attack on the target, and there was a seagull sitting on the target. I never quite knew whether I hit the seagull or not, but with Carey's instruction and following the advice that he gave, you could make the Hurricane really talk in terms of its difficulty to hit by this combination of a lot of rudder and a lot of aileron, and then straightening out at the last minute, getting the pipper on in a quick burst. Another thing he emphasized was the importance of the short burst at the right range, rather than long bursts that so many people tended to do when they were attacking a ground target or when they're attacking an air target. So I came back. I think I finished second on that course. I was I had a strip torn off me in a joking way by the squadron back in Ceylon. We were then down at Minorea, because the neighbouring squadron that was with us there, the Australian pilot, was the chap who finished up first on the course. So they gave me hell for not finishing top. But I quite enjoyed. Then I actually joined a pilot attack instructor's flight at Trincomalee, and all the fighter squadrons that were going out through the Far East were given training in tactics of how to deal with the Japanese. Their air-to-ground and air-to-air and air-fighting tactics all sharpened up, and this therefore allowed me to get my hands on a number of aeroplanes, like the Corsair, for example, and the Spitfire, and I even flew an Avenger, which towed the targets It was quite an interesting period. And then suddenly my time had run out for my overseas tour, and in 1945 I came back to England, was posted to the Spec End course at Shawbury, and for some reason or other, they decided that this was not for me, and I was sent up to No. 65 Fighter Squadron at Peterhead, where we were doing long-range escorts of bowfighters and mosquitoes over to Denmark and Norway, the Cataract and the Skagerrak. Well, you can pronounce it better than I do. You know what I mean, where I mean.
Skagerrak.
Skagerrak and Cataract.
Yeah. What was the Spec End course?
That was the specialist navigation course. I'd been rather accustomed to pointing my own aeroplane in roughly the right direction and hopefully getting the target and back, so I didn't really fancy the idea anyway of spending too much time on a specialist navigation course. It wasn't quite my cup of tea, so I didn't particularly mind not being retained on that.
What did you fly in Scotland then?
We were flying the Mustang 3 and the Mustang 4, which is they were beautiful aeroplanes. They had very long range and high cruising performance. They were
drop tanks?
Oh yes, drop tanks. And we, you know, we were doing 6 and 7 hour flights across the North Sea. And that was, I guess, late spring, so the water was very cold. So your chances of survival, unless you got into your dinghy quickly, were very dubious indeed. We had air superiority at that time, so it was ground fare, really, that we were mainly worried about. And I remember one chap flying next door to me suddenly went up in flames and had the presence of mind to jettison the drop tank, and it was the drop tank that was on fire, and he got away with it, was able to fly back. So that over, I had to make a decision when the war came to an end. What was I going to do? Go back to finish my apprenticeship in electrical engineering or stay with the Royal Air Force? And of course by then flying had become part of my life, and I just couldn't picture my going back to continue.
Can I just interrupt you at this point before you leave the war years? Because I'm very interested, when you're flying an aeroplane in combat, you're concentrating on aiming your guns, on getting at the enemy. Are you concentrating on your instruments all that much in the process? I mean, surely there are times when you stray outside the performance envelope of the plane, you don't put enough power on in a tight turn, for instance, or something like that. Or do you find that most of these fighter aircraft are designed to take up those aeros and to stay in the sky for as long as possible?
The aeroplane really becomes part of you. It's strapped to your backside. And therefore, you can almost tell instinctively whether you're getting if you've got any feeling at all for flying, you can instinctively tell whether you're getting the best out of the aeroplane. And, of course, with practice, you learn to fly with a minimum of slip or skid, because during the training you periodically have glanced down to your turn and slip indicator to make sure that the slip needle is in the middle. So really it's very much a question of eyes out of the cockpit and looking through into the gun sight and the mirror and keeping an eye on what the hell's going around you, because that's the most important point of survival. You're assuming that apart from a quick glance at things like radiator temperature and oil pressure, that everything's going to burn and churn, because you're dealing with, generally speaking, a very reliable power plant. I'm thinking particularly now of the Merlin engine. I mean, that's a marvellous bit of kit. Even when it was running on Indian petrol, which was part water, it seemed to cough its way out of trouble without too much difficulty. So, the main thing was, one, survival, and giving the best account you could against the opposition. And then the secondary job, of course, was cursory glance around the cockpit to make sure there wasn't an oil pressure gauge down at zero or a radiator temperature off the clock, because if that happens, I mean, you might just as well be shot down, because things are going to happen quickly. So you do spread your attention around, rather, I think, like you do when you're test flying. I mean, you've got certain particular tasks that you've got to be doing. It might be a task of flying to very high incidence to check the engine intake system from a point of view of surge. And therefore, I mean, one, your eyes want to be outside to see what you're doing, but also they'll be monitoring the jetpack temperature very, very carefully, and you can almost pick it up sort of somewhere over here with practice. So, you know, you develop your senses quite a lot, I think, to extend your sense of sight, hearing, smell, taste, feel, all of which are tuned in really to your getting the best professional performance you can out of the airplane.
So anyway, war's in.
Yes, I mean, I have to say this, that really, as far as I was concerned, the war was very kind to me, in that despite the fact that I would love to have been associated with being a Royal Air Force ace in a fighter airplane, it didn't quite work out like that. I just had the misfortune to have a massive motor car accident at the wrong time, but perhaps that saved me from disaster in Burma, where quite a lot of my colleagues later on lost their lives, whereas I was sitting back in the hospital in Calcutta. So I learned a lot about the theory, and I did a number of operations, but none of them were ones in which I came in contact with the enemy, apart from being shot at from the ground. I made the decision, having talked to the managing director, Starling, of Blackburn Starling. He welcomed me back, said, delighted to waive the last years of your apprenticeship, and you can come on at 30 shillings a week, I think, was what I was offered. My apprenticeship started at 10 and sixpence a week. They were kind to me whilst I was in the Royal Air Force and continued to pay my widowed mother 10 shillings a week, which I thought was an extremely nice gesture of them. In fact, I went to visit them only last year and saw the Starling's oil painting in the boardroom and said how much I appreciated his kindness for what he had done there. It was a very nice human gesture, that. But I had to say, you know, flying is now in my blood and that's what I want to do. So I went back to the Royal Air Force, and it was very apparent that the if you really wanted to survive, unless you had a tremendous record as a fighter pilot, instructing was the thing to go for. So I went to Upavon and did the flying instructor's course there. That was on the Oxford aeroplane. And it was only then that I started to realize how ignorant I was about flying. I mean, the finer points of flying. Because I suppose largely due to the approach of the fighter pilot, in which by the very nature of the work you're doing, you're not sticking to any normal rules for very long, because your survival depends on being rather unconventional. So I had to change my tune very considerably, and eventually I passed out. Had a very enjoyable time at that lovely old airfield at Upavon, never thinking that many years later, in the prototype of the Harrier, the so-called prototype, the P-1127, when they had the 75th anniversary at Upavon, I would be the only jet aeroplane ever able to operate from that airfield. So it was very intriguing. And never really in my wildest dreams, when I was in the Royal Air Force, did I ever imagine that I would finish up as chief test pilot on at Hawker Aircraft Limited, because that was looked on as the plum job on fighter aircraft, because submarines had had their day in a big way with the Spitfire, and they'd overdeveloped it rather, and they'd tended to go down as Hawker came up with the Swift, with being eclipsed by the Hunter. And everyone around the industry and at Boscombe Down said, one job you want to try and get, it's a test pilot with Hawker Aircraft Limited. So, for better or worse, I did my session of flying instructing, which really was invaluable in terms of getting in quite a large number of flying hours and flying and getting a good deal of experience with a wide cross-section of pilots. Many of them were pilots who'd been prisoners of war. It was a pilot's refresher flying unit, started off at Wheaton Aston, quite close to my wife's home at Sheriff Hales in Shropshire. So I was able to live at the farm there with my wife. And then we went down to Moreton-in-Marsh. And at Moreton-in-Marsh, I then became very involved with the Harvard. And I'd spent a lot of time on the Harvard on the gunnery flight in Ceylon, so I was very, very familiar with that airplane. And after that, we moved from Moreton-in-the-Marsh up to Finningley. And I had another of my usual sort of exciting incidents in life when we had a caravan at the time because you couldn't get married accommodation and my caravan was being towed up. I'd gone up by air and the chap got out of control and it went across the central reservation and he drove it back to the other side of the central reservation and somewhere near, I think it was Newark, the back axle broke. And well, there was a great big problem there, and, recovering that machine. And we eventually recovered it, got it to a builder's yard where they specialized in caravan work. And we were living in it whilst they were doing some mods to it. The damn thing caught fire in the middle of the night. And it was a Rippingill fireside heater that had gone haywire, paraffin heater. I rushed out to try and get the fire extinguisher from the large workshop, and I couldn't get it. There was a hose, and I turned the tap on, and nothing came out of it. Eventually, the next morning, I found a knot had been tied in it. By then, the caravan was nicely on fire. I said, "Where's Peter?" And Peter was in the end of the caravan. So we got my son, yeah. Peter. He would then be about, I suppose Peter would be about 2 years old by then. We got him out and everything went up in flames. I mean, time of clothes rationing, food rationing, and most of my memorabilia and things like that, photograph albums and everything was written off during that fire. Anyway, we escaped. And so my wife went back to live in Shropshire and I went to the Mass and lived there for quite a time and took a pretty passionate interest in flying instructing. And at that time we also I had also done the Empire Flying School all-weather course, and that was back down at Hillevington again, and it was when the Royal Air Force were trying to get themselves all-weather minded, because it was very hit and miss bad weather flying until that course was introduced. I was on the second course ever, finished up as an instrument rating examiner, and by now at Finningley, we had got Spitfire 16s with a Packard Merlin engine, so my flight was Harvard's and Spitfire 16s. Then the other flight was Oxford's and Wellington's, and then there was an auxiliary squadron that had Mosquitoes, and because I had an instrument rating, I was involved in all these different aeroplanes, so that was very valuable experience for me. I suddenly, having been to Farnborough, I suddenly got the bug about wanting to do the test pilot's course. And the last occasion came to apply for it. I'd applied twice and hadn't got on it because they wanted to get everything they could out of me as a flying instructor first. And Pat Burnett, the wing commander flying, called me and said, "Why do you want to go on this course?" And I said, "Well, I feel that instinctively that I want to be involved with the development of aeroplanes and to see them through their early problems and into service life, to do something new instead of teaching people." He said, "Bedford, do you realize this will prejudice your chances of becoming Chief of the Air Force?" Well, I didn't really know whether to be flattered or shattered on this remarkable comment, since I was a mere flight lieutenant, overdue for promotion. And I had a flash of inspiration. I said, "Yes, sir, but I'm quite happy to settle for deputy." He said, "Under the circumstances, I'm prepared to recommend you. And if Burnett recommends a man for something, it happens." He was a real bullshitter, this man. And I found myself a few months later going to an interview down at Farnborough, where the Empire Test Pilot School was, and meeting a number of characters down there, being interviewed and being accepted for the course. I was on number 8 course in 1949. And that really started to change my whole sort of potential career, because then I got some professional qualification behind me. I was flattered when they asked me to stay on as a tutor at the test pilot school course. I felt it's a case of the blind leading the blind, because I hadn't been involved in test flying. I thought it's rather an unsatisfactory way of doing it, but they wanted also to cash in on my instant rating work as well as on my task as an instructor. Yeah, I mentioned the Australian chap. His name was Squadron Leader Jim Rowlands, who climbed to the top as Chief of the Australian Air Force and then Governor General of New South Wales, and quite a number of characters distinguished themselves. B. Weems, Lieutenant Commander of the United States Navy, did extremely well on the course, and very sad. His uncle was an admiral in the United States Navy who was involved in a lot of development of navigational aids for aircraft and for ships. Sadly, he was killed in observing takeoffs in a small flying boat, and the airplane pitched nose down on takeoff, and that was the end of poor old Jim. Taffy Eccleston, chief, was an experimental test pilot with Henry Page, and he was killed when the tail came off a prototype of the Victor. And Teddy Tennant was chief test pilot of Follen. So, you know, a number of the people on that course made their mark in aviation. It's rather sad that of the 30 members, 15 of them are now no more. So shows how important it is to have your high-performance guardian angel looking after you well. Well, now, during my period at EDPS, the first of the Royal Air Force displays, when they moved from Hendon to Farnborough, was about to take place. And a Flight Lieutenant Miller was doing practice aerobatics in an Olympia glider and killed himself. And the Royal Air Force didn't have another glider, and they approached the Commandant, Group Captain Leonard Snaith of Schneider Trophy fame, a very famous pilot and test pilot in the Royal Air Force, and said, "May we borrow your glider?" Snaith said, "Yes, but you'll borrow one of my pilots." And I got nominated, therefore, to do this aerobatic display at Farnborough, knowing little or nothing about gliders. Snaith made me practice twice a day. I was towed up and went through a full sequence of aerobatics, gradually getting lower and bolder, until eventually I was able to finish up with a high-speed, low-level beat-up, a loop off the deck, a stall turn to land outside the president's tent. But in the process of doing this, one day when I released, I suddenly found that the variometer, which in those days was a green ball for going up and a red ball for going down, was showing up. And I started circling, and I had found a thing called a thermal, and I was hooked. And from then onwards, gliding played a very big part in my life. In fact, it almost cost me a divorce. I occupied so much time on it. But more of that later. After the test pilot's course, I'd been given, after instructing on the, as a tutor, Snaith had told me that I would have some choice in the job that I did at the experimental flying department, Farnborough. And I surely did. I managed to finish up at the aerodynamics research flight, at which all the exotic airplanes like the DH-108 Swallow, the Gloster E-144, and we had an early Sabre F-86, the Armstrong Whitworth Flying Wing, and many unique types of this era were on research programs. An area that I played a very big part in, which acted as a life insurance policy to me in years to come, was a spinning research program on a thing called the Athena. And we were trying to look at the characteristics of the spin and spin recovery of swept-wing airplanes. And by changing the moments of inertia by moving on the ground large lumps of lead to the wingtip or fuselage of the airplane, we could start simulating the behavior of the future swept-wing generation of aircraft on spin and spin recovery. And what started to emerge there was that it was very apparent that the position of the ailerons was going to be really critical on the characteristic of the spin, and particularly the characteristic of the spin recovery. And there's no doubt about it that this was so very true on a large number of aircraft that went into service. The instinctive thing on spin recovery is you think you know which way you're going, so you apply opposite rudder, which normally is the correct thing to do. The second thing is that you normally, not always, push the stick forward, which is an instinctive thing to do. The third thing that you don't do instinctively is to either keep the stick in the middle, or if you're going to apply aileron, you don't instinctively apply it in the direction of the spin. You tend to apply automatically outspin aileron, and that can result in a zero spin recovery. Yes, this is largely on swept-wing aircraft and maybe on certain straight-winged aircraft, dependent on the sort of fuselage wing loading distribution on the aircraft. Quite a lot of hunters had unnecessary spinning accidents, and people would come back with stories either having recovered or having ejected that they fought it all the way down. And in the end, we found on the Hunter, during my test flying with Hawker Aircraft Limited, that if you just took your hands off the stick, the airplane would recover of its own accord, because the spring centering would center the stick so you had no outspin aileron on, and the stick position would be about neutral, and the rudder was not all that critical. So that experience, along with a young boffin called Tom Kerr, who eventually finished up as scientific advisor to the MOD Air, and I think is now working for the company that produces the runway, little runway bomb. That was a very valuable experience, as well as all the other disciplines that went into the work on the AW-52 flying wing. I mean, there we were looking at laminar flow patterns, and the problem with laminar flow was it was marvellous in theory, but in practice, imperfections on the wing could wreck it, and your range could go down very rapidly. Even flies sticking on the wing could be catastrophic. So we used to take off with what was known as a fly sheet covering the entire wing, get up to our cruising altitude and operate a little lever in the cockpit that got rid of the fly sheet, and then we were sure that the wing was clear of any bugs. So I won't go into too much detail of the other sort of work that went on at Farnborough.
Just going back, you mentioned the Athena. I mean, that was a fairly conventional training aeroplane, wasn't it?
The Athena and the Balliol were in competition with each other, and the Balliol was eventually selected as the advanced piston-engine trainer for the Royal Air Force. The Athena was made by Evreux. Mm. Yeah. Mixed up with all this, we had attachments to the National Gas Turbine Establishment, who had a facility at Bitterswell. So we found ourselves flying Lancasters and Lincolns with engines slung underneath, or a Meteor with barrel engines, or a Vampire with some modification to the Goblin engine. And that, again, was a very useful experience to have. Or we would be